That's not what I meant. The Sociolinguistics of Everyday Conversation, Lecture 6, The Rhythms of Talk, Pacing, Pausing, Silence, and Interruption.
This lecture is about the rhythms of talk, pacing, pausing, silence, and overlap and interruption. It's a topic that's really near and dear to my heart because it was one of the first aspects of conversational style that I analyzed in depth. I first addressed issues of conversational style in an extended analysis of a Thanksgiving dinner conversation that took place among six friends, of which I was one. And I've written all this up in a book called Conversational Style. The six friends were of different ethnic and regional backgrounds. So three of us were from New York City and of East European Jewish background. Two were Catholic and one case Irish, the other Italian, from Southern California, the Los Angeles or Irvine areas. And one was from London, England. When I first recorded the conversation, I didn't immediately know that I was going to study it, but I ended up transcribing the entire conversation and analyzing what went on. One of the first things that I came across was the different impressions that were made because of our different habits with regard to the rhythms of talk. The New Yorkers, that is, two of the friends and myself, recalled it that it had been a great conversation. But when I asked the Californians and the British speaker what they remembered about the conversation, they both mentioned that it had been dominated by the New York speakers. Now, this intrigued me. What could have made these very different impressions? I traced these different impressions to differences in our conversational styles with regard to pacing, pausing, and what I would call overlap, that is, more than one voice going at once. What happened was that the three speakers who had grown up in New York City, and again, I was one of them, expected very short pauses, or in some cases, almost no pause at all between turns. So as soon as we heard the conversation kind of winding down and a pause might be threatening, we would keep talking to avoid an uncomfortable silence. And we frequently used overlap, that is, talking along with someone else, as a sign of enthusiastic listenership. A term I use is cooperative overlap. Overlaps were not necessarily intended to take the floor. It was just a way to encourage the floor, kind of grease the wheels. The speakers from California, however, and even more the speaker from London, England, expected somewhat longer pauses between turns. So frequently they would be waiting for the right pause so that they could get into the conversation, and that pause would never come because the New Yorkers were constantly filling the pauses to avoid an uncomfortable silence. And that resulted in an imbalance of talk. Now, it wasn't that the New Yorkers did all the talking, but the Californians and the British women tended to talk more when they were telling a story or could just get the floor and hold it for a while. But it was hard often for them to find the right way to get in. And this, I didn't understand it immediately, but when I transcribed the conversation and looked at the transcript and I timed the pauses with a stopwatch, is when I concluded that what was causing this imbalance that led to the impression on the Californians and the British woman that it was somehow dominated by the New Yorkers was a result of these different habits with regard to pacing and pausing. Now, this can happen anytime two people speak to each other and have a different sense of conversational rhythm. It will always be the case that the speaker who is expecting the longer pause is going to have a hard time speaking because the shorter pause comes first. And what's interesting here is that if an interruption results, each one blames the other. So the person who's waiting for the pause or is talking pauses within their turn and then loses the turn because the other person starts talking, will feel that they've been interrupted. But often that interruption is not really the single-handed doing of one speaker. It's the effect of the interaction of the styles. In other words, for an interruption to occur, two things have to take place. One person is speaking, another person begins speaking, and then the first person has to stop. So the interruption is created by the second person beginning to speak and the first person stopping. If the first person didn't stop, there wouldn't be an interruption. Frequently, when the New Yorker would start to speak while the Californian was speaking, and the New Yorker ended up interrupting, the New Yorker would be as surprised as the Californian to find him or herself with the floor. In other words, what had been intended as a cooperative overlap, that is, talking along to show enthusiastic listenership, was misinterpreted as an interruption. So the person who stopped created the interruption along with the person who started speaking. Style differences are always relative. They're never absolute. It's not that one person is a fast talker and the other is a slow talker. One person has long pauses, another one has short pauses. It's always how fast or slow you talk, how long or short your pauses are in relation to the person you're talking to. So I've characterize myself as someone from New York City who tends to be comfortable with relatively short pauses and who is often talks along as a way of showing listenership. I have a friend who is also a colleague. His name is Ron Scollin, and he is from Detroit. Now, when I talk to Ron, I often find that I have to count to seven after I think he has nothing to say. And amazingly, often he will begin to speak because his pauses are a lot longer than mine. Now, Ron Scollin's wife, Suzanne Scollin, is also a linguist. In fact, they've published together. And Suzanne Scollin is from Hawaii, and she is of Chinese-American background. Now, when Ron talks to Susie, often he's the one who ends up interrupting her, and Susie will complain, "You ask me a question, you don't give me a chance to answer. You're asking me another question before I even have a chance to answer the previous one." Because the length of pause that signals to Ron Susie has nothing to say is shorter than the length of pause that Susie expects, that seems self-evident to her, is the natural length of pause. Now, Ron and Susie Scollin do research in northern Alaska, among Athabascan Indians. And when Susie is talking to Athabascan Indians, often she's the one who keeps interrupting them because Athabascan Indians in Alaska, and this, by the way, is similar to many American Indian groups in the lower 48, natural conversation in that cultural context often has very long pauses. Now, it doesn't stop there. Some years ago, Ron and Susie organized a conference, and they invited me up to Alaska to take part in this conference. And when the conference was over, I took a bush flight into a little village 8 miles inside the Arctic Circle called Fort Chukon. And now, I had written this book, Conversational Style, in which I describe my own style, the book about the Thanksgiving dinner conversation. And Ron Scollin's students had read this book, so they knew a little bit about how I characterized my own style. And so he put a question on a midterm exam. Deborah Tannen went to Fort Chukon, and what do you think was her experience there? Now, most of the students gave the response that he expected, which is Deborah Tannen talks as a way of showing interest in people. Athabascan Indians in Fort Chukon, like many other Athabascan Indians, don't talk to strangers, and so she probably didn't find people that eager to talk to her. And in fact, that was what had happened. When I went there, after spending a couple of hours and nobody talked to me, I did what I had not intended to do, which is call the local missionaries so that I could have somebody to talk to. Well, that's what Ron expected in answer to the question, but a student who came from the northernmost village in the Arctic Circle answered the question this way. He said, "People in Fort Chukon talk so fast, she probably fit right in." So whether you're a fast talker or a slow talker always has meaning only relative to the speed and the pausing of the conversational style of the person you're talking to. The result of conversational style is always an interaction of styles. It's never the single-handed doing of one person. Now, our assumptions about and our reactions to talking along, like all other aspects of conversational style, they're automatic and they're very deeply rooted. So whether you take talking along to be a show of interest or you take it to be an interruption, another way we might put it, whether you take it to be a power maneuver or a connection maneuver, is going to seem to you self-evident. And so we draw conclusions about the other person as a person, their personality, in general or their attitude toward us. And if you associate that person with a particular ethnic group, you may draw stereotypes about the group. So people will accuse each other, you're not interested in what I have to say, you only want to hear yourself talk, or on the other side, you're withholding, you never say what's on your mind. And these could be the two people in the same conversation. An interesting example of that came up. I was actually being interviewed on a radio talk show about this topic, and somebody called in and she said that this was a difference between herself and her husband, and it was something that was a source of a lot of frustration and over the many years that they had lived together. She said that they have people over for dinner, and when the people, she thinks it's a great conversation, but when the people leave, her husband will accuse her of not giving him a chance to talk because she did so much talking. And she told me over the phone, which I heard on the radio, she said, and I say to him, you're a big boy, you can get into the conversation. And then I heard his voice in the background saying, you need a crowbar to get into those conversations. So the conclusion that they're drawing is not about conversational style features, and that is you don't go away saying, well, the problem is I need a few seconds more pause, or the problem is, you know, I don't look for pauses and you do. But they're drawing conclusions about each other's personalities and psychology. So she says, you're a big boy. You can get into the conversation. She's assuming that he has the same ability she has. But when your conversational style is different, you actually have different abilities because over time, she has lots of experience jumping into conversations like that, and her antenna are rolled out. She has a real sense of when is the time to come in, when is a person finished with what they're saying, when are they beginning to wind down, here's a good place for me to come in. Because he's attuned to very different signals, longer pauses, he can't pick up those very subtle signals about when is a good time to come in, and he really can't come in. So it isn't a matter of being a big boy. It's a matter of abilities that you develop over time, given your conversational style and your experience in conversation. A woman who has a French-Canadian background and is married to an American from the Midwest commented, when she met her husband's family for the first time, they said, you know, Sally's really nice, but she talks so much. She found that when talking to her husband's family, she had to almost rein herself in, hold herself back, and not always burst out with talk when she felt like it, but wait so that she could give them a chance to talk and she wouldn't do all the talking. And it's interesting. She's very fond of her family. She loves them. They get along very well. But she never feels completely herself when she's around them because she can't just pull out all the stops and let her instinctive conversational style have free rein. She has to kind of watch it. And I think many of us have that experience when you have to adjust your style to somebody else. It's not that you can't do it, but it doesn't feel quite as relaxed as it would if you can just talk in your natural way and have it be understood exactly as you mean it. Now, in giving the examples that I've given so far of these conversational style differences with regard to pacing and pausing and conversational rhythms, I've identified all the speakers by the ethnic and regional background. So French, Canadian, Eastern European, Jewish, Chinese from Hawaii, Athabascan Indian. And that's because rhythms and pacing and pausing are among the conversational signals and devices that are most influenced by ethnic and regional background. In my own study, the speakers that I describe as having, and the word that I use is a high involvement style, come from New York City and of East European Jewish background. And the way I define high involvement style is that the logic behind the style is that you show you're a good person by showing your involvement. As we said earlier, we're all trying to find in our conversations the right balance between closeness and distance to an appropriate degree and balancing that with issues of power and hierarchy. So with a high involvement style, you feel like your biggest job, your biggest responsibility in conversation is to show your involvement, to show your interest, your enthusiasm, And you do this with a whole range of styles. So you might stand closer. Your voice might be a bit louder. Your stories might be more likely to be personal. You might ask a lot of personal questions to show interest in the other person. And having these short pauses and talking along as a way of showing that you're listening are all part of this high involvement style. I don't think it really is so much New York. I mean, we associate it with New York, of course, but I believe it's really the Eastern European influence that is crucial here. And so speakers of other Eastern European countries like Polish, Russian, Yugoslavian will also have these similar high involvement styles. In fact, there was a study done by a Finnish linguist who had done work in Russia, and she found communication between speakers from Finland and speakers from Russia to fall into very similar patterns to the one that I described between the Eastern European Jewish New Yorkers and the Californians. In other words, the high involvement style characterized the Russians, and the Finns often found themselves finding it hard to get in and know what to say, have a hard time getting the floor. So there are many other cultures, Mediterranean, so Italian, Greek would be an example, Armenian, African-American, some South American cultures would be described by this high involvement style. I'm going to read a field note by a student of Italian-American background that describes how these conversations might appear. This is how Maureen Russo described her experience. "This past Saturday," she writes, "I worked at a big convention gala sponsored by the company I interned for, the National Italian American Foundation. I recall specifically sitting in one seminar speech-type event called The Italian Vote, Does It Count?, in which politics, guests, and general participants discussed the characteristics of Italian Americans as ballot holders. I put the word discussed in quotes because anyone who walked into the room would think it was a heated debate that took a turn down the road to outright aggressiveness. Whoever was talking was shouting," and she writes shouting in caps so that we get it, "and waving their hands about wildly. Nobody really held the stage long because the various participants from the audience didn't wait for turns or to be called on. They just stood up and started talking over each other. In some ways, it was chaos. Chaos Italian-American style. But when I stopped to listen to what was actually being said, I realized that most of the people who appeared to be battling each other weren't even disagreeing. They just spoke so aggressively that it made it look and sound as though they were arguing their point against a stubborn opponent. Pounding fists on hands, raising volume, turning to the audience with dramatic outstretched arms for approval or applause." And she comments that she didn't join the discussion herself, but she did find that she enjoyed watching it very much. So this is an example of how talking along and talking over each other was not perceived as an interruption, or you might say it was an interruption, but the interruption did not have a negative value. And again, that's where, as we talked about earlier, we can talk about the ambiguity of the conversational signal of talking along, or we can talk about the polysemy, that is, having more than one meaning at once. So if we talk about ambiguity, we could say talking along could be an interruption, or it could just be a way of showing enthusiastic participation. And in Maureen Russo's description, clearly people were talking at the same time as a sign of enthusiastic participation. They weren't even disagreeing with each other. But at the same time, we might say it's polysemy, that is, having both meanings at once, that maybe there was a kind of competitive cutting each other off, but at the same time, that created a sense of solidarity. And so it was polysemous. It was both interruption, but also creating a sense of solidarity and connection by participatory listenership. And so the fact that these were Italian Americans was probably not a coincidence, because this is a style that is associated with many Mediterranean cultures. People also have talked about interruption and overlap as something that sometimes comes into play when women and men talk to each other. So there was a very classic study by Candace West and Don Zimmerman, and they tape-recorded conversations, that is, pairs of conversations with women-men pairs, and they found that the men tended to interrupt the women more than the women tended to interrupt the men. Now, Candace West went on and studied physicians, and she found, again, that even when women were the physicians, they were more likely to be interrupted by patients than when the physicians were men. But it still leaves open the question of whether talking along is always an interruption or whether it might not be participatory listenership. And here a very interesting study comes to mind. Deborah James and Sandra Clark surveyed 54 different studies that had looked at interruptions and overlaps in conversations between all female groups, all male groups, or mixed groups. And there was a very interesting finding. They actually found that people who looked at all women's groups tended to find more talking at once than they found in conversations among all male groups. And yet the key to this puzzle was not that women were interrupting each other so much in the power sort of way, but that often those interruptions were for solidarity. In other words, they were talking along to show participatory listenership. So the issues of gender and the issues of culture both come into play when we look at patterns of interruption, overlap, and rhythm. A colleague commented to me that she had a student, and she was on the faculty of a university in California in the Los Angeles area, that she had a student who had come from New York, a woman, who said, "I'm tired of being told I talk like a man. What I talk like is a New Yorker." And I think what the colleague that told me the story had in mind was that probably what people were reacting to was her tendency to talk along with other people, which to her was something she had simply learned growing up in New York and was a positive thing, a way of showing enthusiastic listenership. But it was perceived as an interruption, and people thought she was talking that way because she was talking like a man. In other words, men are more likely to interrupt. The effect of interruption when men talk to women, and it does seem to be pretty good evidence that that does happen, that women are interrupted more than men, could have so many explanations. So one explanation could be that people, men talking to women, feel, well, you know, women, it's easy to talk over the woman. Why not do it? Or maybe she doesn't, what she has to say is less likely to be important, so might as well just barge in. But it's also possible, and I'm not saying here which would be in any specific instance, but it's very possible that a man who interrupts a woman actually didn't expect the woman to stop. Again, on the model of that New York-California conversation that I analyzed. So he might feel, hey, this is great. You know, let's get this competitive conversation going where I'll interrupt you, you interrupt me, we can talk over each other, we can get louder and louder. This is going to really be fun. And yet she may feel that she's being interrupted and just stop. So it's always important to keep in mind whenever there's an interruption that it is never the doing of one person. It's always the doing of two people, the one who started and the one who stopped. When I describe the conversational style of denizens of New York City as high involvement style, I realize that I always run the risk of reinforcing a cultural stereotype. Now, this is tricky because my goal in doing that research, at least in part, was to overcome a cultural stereotype. So the thinking in my mind would go, people get the impression that speakers from New York City may be overbearing or dominant, but that's because the interaction of the style is causing a result that would not have been the result if all the speakers shared the style. So when the three New York speakers spoke to each other in that Thanksgiving dinner conversation, they spoke about equally. So somebody talked along with someone else, the first person didn't stop. Someone expected a very short pause, while the other one expected a very short pause too. So they did not end up dominating within the conversation among those three. But in interaction with people who didn't share the style, the effect was domination. And so again, the effect is the interaction of styles, not the individual style. So in a way, my argument there is the impression of any high involvement speakers, and in this case, speakers from New York City, as being dominant or overbearing, is actually a misunderstanding of a style feature by people who don't share that style. But I realize that it runs the risk of people hearing the description and drawing the conclusion, oh yeah, I always knew New Yorkers are overbearing, you know, and this just reinforces it. Well, We have to realize that cultural stereotyping frequently comes from these differences in conversational style. And my hope is that when we understand these style processes, we can overcome some of the stereotypes. Very interesting article by two linguists from Finland, Jaakko Lehtonen and Kari Saivaara, together did a study of rate of speech and mutual stereotyping in a whole range of cultures in Europe. And so they found, for example, that when people who grew up in Finland, that is Finns, spoke to Swedes, often the Finns were the ones that had a hard time getting the word in edgewise and were seen as having nothing to say. In fact, there's a stereotype in Scandinavian countries of Finns as very silent. There's a stereotype of the silent Finn. There's a joke, in fact, that captures that stereotype. A Finn and a Swede meet in a bar somewhere in the far north, and the Swede says, this is very good beer. And they keep drinking, and an hour passes, and the Swede again says, yeah, I really do like this beer. And another hour passes, and they're just both sitting there and drinking their beer, and the Swede says, I wonder what company made this beer. And the Finn says, did you come here to drink or to talk? So that small amount of talk, which to us would seem very little, to the Finn seems like a lot because Finns are so silent. The joke builds on that stereotype. Well, Lehtonen and Saivaara were really interested in this phenomenon, and they looked at studies and perceptions across a number of countries in Europe, and they discovered that whenever two cultures were in contact and one tended to speak more slowly than the other, the group that spoke more slowly was always stereotyped negatively as being dumb. And so the silent Finn is a negative stereotype, as if the Finn is kind of dumb. Well, they found the same thing with French attitudes toward Belgians, in Germany toward East Frisians, among the Swiss toward residents of Bern or Zurich, and among the Finns themselves toward people who come from a region of Finland called Hame. We see something similar in the United States, where Americans who come from the Northeast, Northerners in general, maybe New York City in particular, are stereotyped as aggressive. And people who come from the southern part of the United States are seen as polite, but perhaps not as bright and efficient as Northerners. And a lot of this can be traced to these differences in conversational style norms with regard to how quickly people speak and how long and short those pauses are, what the conversational rhythms are. It's difficult, but again, it's really crucial to think in terms of style rather than personality, intentions, abilities, or when it comes to group cultural stereotypes. Because our responses are emotional and they're automatic, we tend to blame the other person for making us feel the way we feel in reaction to them. So if you're talking to someone and you feel you don't get a word in edgewise, it's so automatic to blame them that their intention is not to let you speak. Or if you're talking to someone and they aren't saying anything, it's so automatic to think they don't want to say anything and to blame them. Not long ago, I was talking to a woman in her 60s. She grew up in the Midwest, but she's living in the Bronx, and she had lived in the Bronx for some 40 years. And we were talking about this, and she said, yeah, it's true that she cringes when New Yorkers stand too close, talk too loud, and when they seem to be interrupting her. And I said, gee, you know, you've lived in the Bronx now for 40 years. Do you find that you're getting used to it? And her response was so automatic, she said, no, I still feel invaded. So despite years and years and years of exposure, her reaction was still that reaction that had been formed from her own conversational style growing up in the Midwest. Yet knowing that these differences may be conversational style differences rather than personality or intentions toward us is still a great relief. It's a relief to understand how others respond to you. So a woman in the same conversation commented, they had been friends. She had seen the woman withdraw, kind of recoil when she moved in too close or talked too loud. And she said, it's such a relief to know it's not personal. It's not that you don't like me. It's that there's something about my style that doesn't click with your style. So both of them were feeling a sense of relief in that conversation. It is possible to adapt your style. So if you find you're the one doing all the talking, you could try counting to 7 before starting to talk and see whether the other person has something to say. If you find that you're not getting a chance to talk, you could try pushing yourself to start sooner. And I actually have an example where it worked that way for a woman. This was a woman who told me she had run workshops together with a man, and she felt that he was completely taking over. Whenever anyone asked a question, he would be in there with the answer, never gave her a chance to answer a question. And she really took this as a sign that he didn't respect her. He didn't want to give her a chance. He just wanted to do it all himself. After, it was actually someone in my class, after hearing this explanation of differences in pacing and pausing, it occurred to her maybe she should start pushing herself to start speaking a bit more quickly. And an amazing thing happened. If somebody asked a question, she pushed herself to start answering the question before it seemed to her natural to do so. But she just pushed herself to start a little faster. And the man that she ran workshops with was delighted. He was thrilled. He said to her, "Wow, I'm so glad you're finally doing your part." So she thought he was intentionally taking over. Apparently, he was filling in because he felt she simply wasn't doing her part. So if you understand about conversational style, you can adapt your style in these ways. So sometimes you'll be able to use your understanding of conversational style differences to actually change a situation. Sometimes there won't be anything you can do to change the situation, but just understanding it in terms of conversational style can lift a burden. So if you are having problems that couldn't in any way be traced to rhythms, pacing, pausing, and attitudes towards silence, you can try doing things differently, and that may solve the problem. Sometimes you may find there really isn't anything you can do to change it. Sometimes just understanding the conversational style may be the root of the problem in itself can be a big relief.
This ends Lecture 6. If you borrowed this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399, and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.